It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the bills that Governor Walker signed into law today dealing with domestic violence.
Public speaking remains one of the most dreaded activities for people today, despite the fact that it's not life-threatening and tends to be over pretty quickly. But what if you want to do more than get over your fear of public speaking? What if you really want to shine or communicate big ideas?
Our next guest examined more than 500 different TED Talks, the viral idea-spreading 18-minute talks from leaders in the fields of technology, entertainment, design, and more. Among the many TED Talks, some of the most influential have been watched millions of times and inspired, enlightened, and educated people around the world.
Carmine Gallo joins us now to share his insights on why some TED Talks bring down the house. He's a communications coach and former anchor and correspondent for CNN and CBS. He's the author of the new book, Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. Carmine, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. What a fun topic.
Well, why does it matter how well we do, you know, when we're trying to convey our ideas to people and we have to do it through public speaking? Why does it matter?
Yeah, I think ideas are, I like to say, the currency of the 21st century. So you're only as valuable as your ideas. And the ability to persuasively communicate your ideas, to get those ideas across, to get those ideas to spread, as the TED conference likes to say, is really one of the most valuable tools that you can have to create movements, to spark movements, to inspire people, to back your agenda, or to even get behind your ideas. Billionaire Warren Buffett was actually giving a small class in front of some MBA students. And he said, and this was great. It's actually on YouTube. He actually told them, "I'll give you $100,000 for 10% of your future earnings, but if you're a good public speaker, I'll give you $150,000." So he understood. He understands the power for whether it's entrepreneurs or business leaders, or people who are just involved in real change, who want to make big changes in the world, that they have to be able to communicate their ideas persuasively and in a way that engages us and touches us and inspires all of us.
Well, you watched about 500 of the best TED Talks. What was that experience like for you, watching so many of these great public speakers?
Well, I'll have to be honest, they're not all great. Just because you've actually given a TED Talk doesn't mean that they are the most fabulous presentations. Because as you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, that there are what are called the smaller sister TEDx talks. And those are given in 145 countries. So I did analyze about 500 TED Talks, and many of them were categorized as the best in some way. So they were either the most inspiring or the ones that had the most views, things like that. And what I found is that all of the great TED Talks, in terms of how are we going to define it, let's define great as the most viral, the ones that got like 20 million views, which is pretty extraordinary for a 18-minute presentation. The best ones, the most viral, are those presentations that have three components. They're emotional, which means that they touch my heart before they reach my head. They touch me emotionally. We could talk about why that is. They're also novel. They introduce things that are surprising, new or unexpected, and they're certainly memorable. So there are a number of different ways that people can make their presentation memorable.
And I think we've got a case in point for you here. Ken Robinson, which I believe, at least as of my Google today, is the most watch TED Talk millions of times. Sir Ken Robinson talking about why he thinks schools are killing creativity. And we have a clip here of one of them, so we can illustrate what we're talking about a bit. Here he is telling a story about a school play with four-year-olds playing the Three Wise Men.
The three boys came in, little four-year-olds with tea towels on their heads, and they put these boxes down. The first boy said, "I bring you gold." And the second boy said, "I bring you mare." And the third boy said, "Frank sent this." What these things have in common, you see, is that kids will take a chance. You know, if they don't know, they'll have a go. Am I right? They're not frightened of being wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that being wrong is the same thing as being creative, What we do know is if you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. If you're not prepared to be wrong. And by the time they get to be adults, most kids have lost that capacity. They have become frightened of being wrong. And we run our companies this, by the way. We stigmatize mistakes. And we're now running national education systems where mistakes are the worst thing you can make.
And a clip there from the most watched TED Talk with Sir Ken Robinson talking about creativity in education. Carmen, what do you hear when you hear that clip?
One, I hear humor. Lighten up. Some of the best TED Talks are funny. Rod Martin, who's a psychologist, said that over the past century, a sense of humor has become a highly prized personality characteristic. And so you see this in many of the TED Talks. I actually saw this in a Bill Gates TED Talk when he was speaking about the effects of malaria on children. How can you inject humor into such a serious topic? And yet, if you can find a way, not of telling a joke, the most interesting thing I just heard from that Ken Robinson clip is that he doesn't start with a joke. You know, he doesn't talk about, hey, two guys walk into a bar. Let me start with a joke. It's more anecdotal humor. Much of Ken Robinson's 18-minute talk has to do with himself, so a lot of it is a humorous observation about himself or his life or about short stories that he heard. And so he introduces humor, and then he ties it right back to his main theme, which is, in order to be successful, you have to be prepared to be wrong and to accept that and to be okay with that. So in terms of Ken Robinson's talk, we can learn something from all the best TED Talks. From Ken Robinson's, I learned that you have to have a sense of humor, not telling a joke, but at least to elicit a smile on somebody's face. He also did something interesting, too. It's called unexpectedness. The best, the most viral talks are those that shock you in some way, that deliver something surprising or unexpected. Why schools kill creativity? Well, that doesn't make sense. Schools foster creativity, don't they? So simply by having the theme, schools kill creativity, it automatically perks your attention. It grabs your attention and you want to know more because it actually jars you out of your preconceived notions. So there's that element of unexpectedness in his theme. Again, these are very common themes that do seem to crop up in some of the best presentations.
Now, in terms of using a moment where a jaw might drop, something that's novel, what if your idea is not necessarily something that has that component? Is there a way to talk about your idea that could make it sound new again and to breathe fresh life into it?
Yeah, I think you nailed it right there, which is breathing fresh life into it, because a lot of ideas aren't necessarily new or earth-shaking. We're not always introducing a groundbreaking idea or even a product that's going to revolutionize the world. But there are certainly ways of packaging ideas into something that's fresh. As long as the human brain can see something introduced in a new and novel way. And that's why Bill Gates actually has been working really hard on this. He has to deliver pretty complex information. And a lot of it is just updates. Here's how we're doing with reducing childhood deaths caused by malaria. A lot of these are updates. And he has really thought through, how do I communicate ideas in a way that really grabs people's attention? And they talk about my presentation. I know this is a fact. So Bill Gates in 2009 gave a TED Talk that went viral, and people still remember it to this day, where he released a jar of mosquitoes on the TED stage. And he was making the point that malaria is caused by mosquitoes. I happen to have some right here. And he opened the jar and he let a few mosquitoes roam around the auditorium. Well, they were literally only a few mosquitoes, but everybody started talking about it like Bill Gates released a swarm of mosquitoes. I like that metaphor, the whole thing about releasing mosquitoes. Obviously, you're not going to do that in your next presentation, but you have to think about, how am I going to take this subject matter and make it unique, interesting, surprising, shocking, something that people don't expect. They did not expect Bill Gates, in the middle of a PowerPoint discussion on malaria, to release mosquitoes. So what is your mosquito type of event? What is that one way of creating a demonstration, maybe introducing a product or a way of talking about that product or introducing a person that the audience did not expect you to do. It could be something very simple. It could just be a simple story. But it has to be something unexpected, fresh, novel, and surprising.
We're talking right now with Carmine Gallo. He is a communications coach, former anchor and correspondent for CNN and CBS, and he's the author of the new book, Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. And we're learning now about what goes into great public speaking. And we'd love to hear from you on this. What most intimidates you about public speaking, and what is the best, most persuasive talk that you've ever heard, maybe the most jaw-dropping talk, and how did you yourself get better at public speaking? Share your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the best TED Talks and what they can teach us about public speaking. TED Talks being the groundbreaking viral series of 18-minute talks covering technology, entertainment, design, and more. We're talking with Carmine Gallo, communications coach, former anchor, and correspondent for CNN and CBS. His new book is called Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. And we're curious about your public speaking moments. What is the most persuasive talk that you've ever heard? Do you think it matters to be able to convey your ideas in a way that inspires people, energizes people, and gets across your own passion about something? And why do you think we're so intimidated about public speaking? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first call. Now we've got Marcus with us in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I have a question or comment about public speaking for newscasters, in particular the weather people. Now they're a lot of them, especially in the morning news shows, they're doing these full body shots where you can see the whole person starting out the weather. And every time they start it out, when they go to that weather person, they take three or four steps forward towards the camera. And it's like everyone does exactly the same thing. And I just wondered, it just seems so staged. It seems like it's this basic 101 rule. The first thing you do is you approach the camera or something. I don't know.
Gotcha. I'm glad you brought that up, Marcus. It gets at the idea that you write about this, Carmine, being authentic, having authenticity. How much does that matter? And what about the weatherman thing?
Oh, absolutely. I was a newscaster myself. So absolutely. Marcus is right. They bring in consultants. And what do the consultants do? You must look a certain way and make sure that you're turning toward your co-anchor while she's reading or he's reading, and turn this way and act this way. And what happens? It all starts looking the same. It's all stilted and robotic. That's why people sort of poke fun at the television news types. You know, and hey, I was one of them. And I understand, because it all starts to look very much the same. You played a clip by an educator, Ken Robinson, who brought down the house. He was very different. It's authentic. It's natural to who he is. The hardest part about writing a public speaking book is you do not want people to read these examples, watch the videos, and then try to be like somebody else. That's the toughest part. If you try to act like somebody who you have seen on a TED Talk, you lose your authenticity. So you have to take some of the best techniques, like storytelling. If you know that people connect emotionally with your audience through the power of story, you can tell stories that are authentic to yourself. But the minute you try to act like somebody else is the minute you lose that genuine connection with your audience. And that's the trickiest part about teaching public speaking.
But don't you have to practice a lot to get it right? You should probably practice, you know, before an empty room. And doesn't that bleed some of the authenticity out of it?
Okay, you bring up another quite complex event. I recommend practicing as much as possible. And a lot of people think, well, that's counterintuitive, because if you practice too much, then you sound stilted, you sound robotic. I found, and maybe this is one of the big surprises for me, I found it to be quite the opposite. Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor became a viral sensation when she talked about her stroke of insight on a TED stage. Oprah then discovered her, and you know, she's become a best-selling author and a very popular personality. She told me that she practiced her TED Talk 200 times.
Wow.
200. When is the last time you practiced a presentation or a pitch 200 times, let alone 10 times.
Yeah,
most of
a lot
us
of times.
Don't do that. And what happens, though, what happens is when you can practice, it frees you up. It gives you confidence. It helps you overcome that stage fright because you've already done this 200 times. You know exactly what you're going to say and how you're going to say it, and then you can start focusing on your delivery and your body language and the way you deliver that information. So rather than becoming robotic or stilted and stale because you practiced it, you've over-rehearsed it, I find, at least with some of the best presenters and public speakers, that the more they practice, the more comfortable they are in their skin, and it really allows them to come alive. So it sounds counterintuitive.
So you're saying practicing kind of sets you free?
It certainly does, because so many of us are afraid of public speaking. And that's very natural. Warren Buffett, who I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Warren Buffett said he was terrified of public speaking when he was younger. So many of us are. There are great pastors who preach in front of tens of thousands of people on weekends who have said they were terrified of public speaking. How do you get past it? You've got to do it like anything else. You have to practice it and do it as much as you can. Most of us don't have the opportunity to give a PowerPoint presentation 10 times a day, right? If you did, you wouldn't be nervous the next time you gave a presentation. So I really think that the more you practice, the more comfortable you are with your story, the more confidence it gives you. I know it's helped me, and it's helped a lot of people who I talk to.
Now, something else you're big on that we're already talking about it, the passion that a lot of the best TED Talks convey. And yet a lot of us are kind of locked down when it comes to revealing our emotions. That feels vulnerable. How do you get yourself to a point where you feel comfortable sharing something that's probably personal and sharing a raw emotion with a big group of people?
Yeah, I think you need to ask yourself, what is it that I'm passionate about? Which is a lot different than what do I do, or what is my idea, or what is my product that I'm trying to talk about today. What you're passionate about typically goes toward how your product, service, or idea is going to help people live a better life. And I think you need to be open and vulnerable and transparent when it comes to that. I learned a lot from Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook COO. And Sheryl Sandberg gave a TED Talk several years ago, I think it was 2010, and that TED Talk launched a best-selling book, which was Lean In, and that book launched a movement. I argue that the book, actually it was 2012 when she gave that talk. I argue that if she had not been passionate and vulnerable and told personal stories about herself, it never would have led to a book. It never would have led to this movement where millions of women are trying to balance, their career and their personal life by leaning in, right? I don't think that movement would have started if it had not been for Sheryl Sandberg's ability, right before she went on stage, to ask herself, what is it that I really want to tell people? I have to get beyond the data, beyond the numbers, and I have to really let people into my own story. And she told many personal stories, which she was a little reluctant, and she admitted this. She was reluctant to tell personal stories. She just wanted to deliver data.
And speaking of personal stories, I want to get one more caller in before we have to let you go. Real quickly, sure. Mark in Oconomowoc. Hi, you're next.
Hi, I do want to just put the dovetail into what you were talking about and practicing, and I was just nodding my head, and anybody ever needed to get the practice in for public speaking, is get down to your local community theater. It certainly will open up your abilities, and when you were talking about practicing and doing the same thing over many times, it works very well because then you have an understanding of telling that story and feeling confident and comfortable.
Okay, great suggestion, Mark, and a way of getting that practice in. What do you think about doing theater, Carmine?
I have a theater background. I knew when I was in college, actually, I went to UCLA, and I knew I needed to be much more comfortable in front of groups, so I enrolled in theater. So it doesn't surprise me or shock me that many of the great presenters that I have interviewed, not only for TED but for other books as well, the best public speakers are those who have a little ham in them. You know, they have an experience with either being in theater Or some great speakers, you know, they used to go to church and they learn from great Baptist ministers. There's a guy named Brian Stevenson who gave the longest standing ovation of any TED Talk. And he told me that he learned from going to church on Sundays when he used to watch Baptist ministers. So it's very interesting how people learn how to become persuasive speakers in business or in any other field. They typically learn from studying other presenters or speakers in different fields. So whether it comes from theater or some of these other fields, it's a great way to learn.
We've gotten some great ideas. Carmine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you bet. Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking to Carmine Gallo, communications coach, former anchor and correspondent, and the author of Talk Like TED, The 9 Public Speaking Secrets of the World's Top Minds. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, the governor is signing into law today 3 bills strengthening domestic violence laws in Wisconsin.
The bills were passed by the legislature earlier in the season, and they deal with issues relating to restraining orders, firearms, and stalking.
Joining us now to talk more about these bills is Patty Seeger, executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's take a look at these bills, starting with one that involves domestic violence suspects with guns. This is known as the SAFE Act. What would this one do?
Well, we call it SAFE Act. It's an acronym for Stopping Abuse Fatalities Through Enforcement. And it really just creates an implementation method for a very long-standing law. In Wisconsin, since the early 90s, our law forbid domestic abusers, people who were the subject of a restraining order, from possessing firearms during the term of the restraining order. Yet there was never any implementation procedure written into law that told law enforcement and the courts how to ensure that the surrender of firearms actually occurred. So what we have found is that for many years, most counties in Wisconsin did not actively enforce the surrender requirement. And this bill we introduced, we worked to have introduced several times. This year it passed. It's very significant because we know that guns and domestic violence don't mix, that when guns are present in an abusive relationship, it simply makes an abuser more dangerous and more lethal, and it's more likely that a victim will be killed.
So, Patty, does this bill then create the mechanism for the firearm to be formally surrendered each time?
Yes, it creates a mechanism for the firearm to be surrendered. It also, one of the provisions in current law is that the respondent to an order could give the firearm to a third party. It now requires that the third party come to the court, and the court will educate that person and give them an understanding of the responsibility of holding guns for another person, and that if they violate by giving the gun to the respondent to that order, that they themselves become subject to being charged with a crime.
And another bill takes a look at the issue of stalking. What does that bill address?
Well, it actually adds stalking into the definition of domestic abuse. Wisconsin has an existing definition of domestic abuse in our state law, which does not include stalking, yet we know stalking is present many of the times when domestic violence is occurring. We also know that from our more than 10 years of studying homicides in Wisconsin, that lethality increases exponentially when the abuser is stalking the victim. So we have asked that stalking be added into the definition of domestic abuse, and that was really key and extremely important, so that now it becomes one of those acts that law enforcement and prosecutors and courts can consider and take seriously when arresting and charging and prosecuting for domestic abuse.
So what happened before this bill? If an abuse victim was being stalked, they could, I guess, get a restraining order. Was there anything else that happened?
Well, there is a separate charge of stalking that can happen. And that's a felony in Wisconsin. It's a little bit difficult to prove, and it's not just it's everybody has acknowledged that it can be one of the elements of domestic abuse, but it's just never fallen in our definition. So now when someone seeks a restraining order, for example, if they are being stalked but haven't been physically harmed, but the person is obsessed with them and following them, calling them repeatedly, and that person can show that they're being stalked, that can be the basis for getting a restraining order. Currently, there's not stalking in our restraining order law.
Okay, let's move on to the third bill. This one standardizes some procedural things for police, gives more tools. Walk us through that one.
Sure. The final bill, Senate Bill 160, ensures that law enforcement officers refer victims of domestic abuse to services after the law enforcement officers respond to the scene of a domestic violence incident. Many officers do refer victims to services, but there's no requirement, and many officers don't refer victims. What we know is that connecting victims with services is absolutely critical and can be one of the most significant steps a victim can take to improve his or her safety. And that, you know, victims become very isolated, and many of them aren't even aware that services exist in their community. So when they get a referral from the police officer that tells them that there's a free, confidential 24/7 service available in their community that can help offer them support and services so that they can make choices about their safety, it's absolutely critical.
Patty, what kinds of services are available across Wisconsin for victims of domestic violence?
In Wisconsin, we have 72 counties and 11 tribes, and there are domestic violence services available in all of those counties and tribes. We have about 48 shelters, and shelters provide emergency physical safety in a building that's owned and operated by the program. But there are many, many outreach services as well. There are staff who are trained and prepared to help victims with legal issues, help them assist them, and provide them information about restraining orders, how to obtain them, how to file a police report. Programs also offer support groups, individual counseling, services for their children, for teens, and they do a lot of public education in all of their communities.
Can you give us a sense of how big a problem domestic violence is here in Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, in Wisconsin and nationally and internationally, it's believed that 1 in 3 women are victims of domestic violence. 1 in 7 men are victims. In Wisconsin, we know that local domestic violence programs serve more than 40,000 women, children, and men annually. We know that there are about 30,000 or so arrests and referrals through law enforcement and to prosecutors' offices for domestic violence in the state. Those numbers don't necessarily correspond with each other. Some victims may seek the assistance of a shelter or a domestic abuse program without ever seeking the assistance of law enforcement. So we know that the numbers are large. We know that we also turn away a lot of people. In a single day survey where we did a 24-hour unduplicated count of services in Wisconsin last September, programs turned away more than 270 victims mm-hmm. in a single day and served 1,700 victims in a single day. So we know that, and that's just one single day, you know, multiply that by 365. So we know that there are a lot of people coming forward. We know that there's a high demand for services, and we know that we don't have enough funding to serve everybody.
How are you feeling today with the passage of these three laws? Are you feeling good, or is it still a lot of work to be done?
There's a lot of work to be done, but it's hard to not feel positive when three extraordinary bills are passing, being signed all in one day. We're especially proud of the SAFE Act, which is a bill we worked on for a very long time. It has the support of the law enforcement community and the prosecution community and obviously the victim advocacy community, and many victims are here today, victims of shootings themselves, victims of parents who've lost their children to domestic violence, homicide by gun, in these exact circumstances where the abuser had a restraining order and there was failure to recover the firearms. So it feels like a huge success, and we're really very proud and thankful to the legislators who authored it and thankful to the governor for signing it.
And now that these have passed, what's next on the agenda? What else would you like to see passed next?
Oh, you know, we're regrouping and thinking about what's next for next year. I think we really want to pursue some of the some legislation that helps to address some of the economic impacts that violence has on victims' lives and see if we can do something to help improve that situation for them.
Patty, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Sure. You're welcome. Thank you for covering.
We've been talking with Patty Seeger, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She joined us to talk about the domestic violence bills being signed by Governor Walker today.
With fall elections a little over 6 months away, it's that time of the election cycle when the attention of lawmakers starts to turn from legislation to politics.
Members of Congress are on recess for 2 weeks. Many of them are in their home districts raising money and talking about hot topics like Obamacare.
The word on the street is that the Senate is well within reach for Republicans, and money is pouring in on both sides.
USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time for an inside look at Congress. And this week we'll take a look at some of the most hotly contested congressional seats this fall. Paul, thanks for being back with us.
Always a pleasure, Veronica. How you doing?
Doing pretty well. So it sounds like members are in recess. They're often back in their home districts. So what do you think the message is as they go back to their home states?
Well, I believe part of the message is going to be about Obamacare. The Democrats want to go back to their states and tout some of the success. They want to point out that more than 7 million people have signed up for the Health Care Act. Keep in mind, there's also some private sign-ups that are outside of the federal exchanges. And basically, they're going to try and make the point that, hey, this thing is actually starting to take hold and starting to work. Republicans are going to say just the opposite. They're going to make Obamacare again part of the conversation and say it's a government takeover of your health care. They promise you can keep your doctor and you can't. Prices are going to be going up. And it's bad, 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 and we should fix it.
So are Democrats actually turning to embrace Obamacare at least a little bit? Because prior to this, the message had been sort of distance yourself. It doesn't seem like it's working out that well, and we want to get reelected.
Well, the whole theory has been that they would run away from the law, but I'm not sure that's actually all that true. I mean, I think if it begins to achieve what the intended outcome was, which is people who did not have insurance getting insured, insurance becoming more predictable and more accessible to people who have pre-existing conditions or otherwise are in need, then I think Democrats will be proud to stand up next to it and say, hey, look, we are in the process of fixing the system. I think what you will see is on all fronts, the Democrats will be saying it still needs repair, that it's not a perfect law and it needs to be fixed. But I would not be surprised to see Democrats claiming some success and some pride in their ownership of the law.
So what happens to the Republican message then if Democrats start to embrace Obamacare? Do Republicans continue to attack on that front, or do they change tack?
No, totally.
They're all in.
Yeah, no, the Republicans, because a couple of things are going to happen. We believe that you'll see people having the insurance rates starting to kick in this summer that are slightly more expensive and possibly significantly more expensive than their prior insurance. The Republicans think that sticker shock is going to be a very painful thing. And they're going to, again, say it's the Democrats' fault, it's the Obamacare law fault, this is a bad law. And for a lot of Republicans, the issue is not even the sort of on-the-ground impact of the law. The real implication for them is overreach of government. And you know, the Democrats misnamed this law from the beginning. When they named it the Affordable Care Act, it's not a very catchy name. And so the name that stuck instead, and the Democrats themselves have begun to embrace, is Obamacare. That makes it easy for Republicans to paint as part of Obama's big government outreach, overreach, some sort of imperial presidency. It will be very much part of the message.
Interesting to talk about that as a branding mistake, but
we can
talk about that another time. I want to get to the Senate, because the Senate is hanging in the balance right now. Democrats under the gun to keep it, Republicans looking to take it over. Tell us what's at stake here.
Well, what's at stake is the control of the agenda in Congress. The Republicans need to take a net 6 seats from the Democrats to gain the majority again and control both the House and the Senate. And there are about a dozen races that are very, very close, and the Republicans are clearly within reach if they're able to win some key races, particularly in places like Louisiana, where Democrat Mary Landrieu is running for re-election. Mark Pryor, next door in Arkansas, another Democrat running for re-election. These are states that voted overwhelmingly Republican in the presidential campaign, but they have Democratic senators, both of whom, by the way, voted for the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and both of whom are now very much on the defensive. If the Republicans can take those seats and a few more, they could take control of the Senate.
So how vulnerable are these seats? You mentioned Mary Landrieu from Louisiana and Mark Pryor from Arkansas. Let's take a look at those as sort of bellwethers. Where do they stand?
Well, they're neck and neck. Particularly in the Arkansas seat, the Republicans have a really solid candidate they're really happy with. They have a guy named Tom Cotton. He's a military veteran. He's a young guy. He's been in Congress a few years. He's very good looking, just very energetic and very young, and he's running unopposed for the Republican nomination. So he can already start sort of going at it with Mark Pryor, and they've already been going pretty much, you know, mano a mano. It's hard to tell. I mean, the polls, it's, of course, early in this race. The polls are pretty split. Most recent polls have Pryor maybe ahead by a couple of points, but for an incumbent senator, that is not at all comfortable, and there is millions of dollars pouring into that race. Landrieu, we're still trying to figure out who's going to be running against her, but, again, she's never polling much above 50, and that could be a really, really tough race for her.
Now, on the other hand, Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, looking a little bit vulnerable right now, at least in fundraising. What do you see in that race?
The McConnell race is interesting. The first hurdle he has to get over is a primary. It was expected this was going to be very difficult for him. He had a Tea Party challenger who has accused McConnell of being kind of an institutional Republican, go along with the Democrats, backing the big spending agenda. That candidate, a guy named Bevin, has not really caught fire, and it looks like McConnell will be able to win his primary easily, but he still has to spend money on it. And then waiting in the wings in the general election is a Democrat named Allison Lundergan Grimes, very well known in the state and a very close pal, it turns out, of the Clintons. She's already had Bill Clinton out there campaigning with her. She's bringing in a lot of money. She outraised McConnell in the first quarter of this year, $2.7 million for the first 3 months of the year. It's going to be a slugfest in the general election. And McConnell still, like I said, has to focus on also winning his primary.
Now, we talked about a couple of vulnerable Senate seats in the South for Democrats, Mark Pryor, Mary Landrieu. Can we generalize? Is this, in general, a problem that Democrats have in the South?
Yeah. I mean, if you look across the South, it's very hard for Democrats to win. I mean, if you look at the results of the presidential election, you'll see every time you see a map on the wall, it's red across the bottom all the way. And it is hard for Democrats to win those races. It's also particularly hard because, as we've talked about on this show, there is much less interest in a kind of moderate centrist, get along kind of Congress. There's much less interest in compromise. So the Democrats in the Republican areas, and for that matter, the Republicans in the Democratic areas, are running for their lives because nobody's really interested in having someone stand up and say, yeah, I'm from the other party, but, I can work well across the aisle. That doesn't get you very far.
So what do you make of this race, this midterm race that's shaping up, given what you just said about not being a race for centrists or moderates? What is the characteristic of this race in general going to be?
Well, I think there's two things that are going to be critical. The first is the Health Care Act. This is really going to be the year of the referendum on the Affordable Care Act. If Republicans are going to win, they're going to win in large measure because a lot of people, particularly a lot of white people, are going to come out and vote against what they call Obamacare. That is going to be the motivating factor that drives people to the polls. If the Democrats survive, it's going to be because One, the economy is getting better and people are feeling more comfortable that the economy is getting better. And two, they're going to discover that this healthcare law has turned out to their advantage, that they like it better, it's not as bad as they thought it was going to be, that some of the horror stories didn't come true. I really do believe that, you know, certainly all elections are local elections to some degree, and, you know, Mary Landrieu wants to talk about flood insurance, not Obamacare, but this really is going to be the year that all the national money, all the national attention, and many of these races are going to be about, do you or do you not vote for the Health Care Act?
And Paul, in our last 30 seconds here, if Republicans are successful in taking the Senate, President Obama still in the office, can veto bills, how do politics then actually change in Washington?
Well, you get more divided government, obviously. I think one of the critical things, obviously, is it will be very, very hard for Obama to get any of his agenda items voted on. Currently, he sort of relies on the Senate to bring up the things he cares about, even if the House is going to vote him down. If the Republicans take the Senate, he won't even have that. The budget battles will be fierce because he's got no champion on the Hill.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks. Talk to you later. Bye.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to share his insights on Congress.